This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Muggs. On Wednesday night, as House Speaker Nancy Pelosi slammed the gavel on two articles of impeachment adopted by the House against President Trump, some viewers on Fox broadcast stations watched a live feed in real time, side by side with the season finale of The Masked Singer. Wayne Brady was the Fox, by the way. CBS and ABC broke in with special reports about the impeachment, but swiftly returned to the Survivor finale and the live reboot of All in the Family. After this historic vote, one that made Trump only the third U.S. president to be impeached, are Americans paying enough attention to understand the seriousness of the charges leveled against the president, or is the country more convinced of the counterpoint that the impeachment process has been a sham? We've got a full hour of national politics to discuss, and we've got with us the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Ken, thanks for being back with us.
Thank you, Michael.
Also joining us is Miami University Assistant Professor of Political Science, Dr. Rachel Bloom. Rachel, thanks for being in the studio with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And as always, WVXU Senior Political Analyst Howard Wilkinson. Howard, hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
And we want to hear from you as well. We want to hear your thoughts on the impeachment process, what you think should happen next. And a little later on, we'll be talking about the Democratic presidential debate scheduled for tonight. You can weigh in on all of these things at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and get some of those into the show as well. So before we dive into the very seriousness of today's conversation, we always start with the political junkie trivia question. Ken, what is the question today?
This is more convoluted than usual, but let's see. Hopefully, this will make sense. Who was the last senator currently in office to vote against their party in both counts in a presidential impeachment vote?
Okay, so this is someone who is currently in the United States Senate and voted against the party position before the Senate.
Right.
Okay, so you can think Andrew Johnson administration, Richard Nixon administration, Bill Clinton administration.
Never came to a vote.
So we'll have to see. And as always,
shut up, Howard.
We let our panelist take a guess, and we'll get a correct answer later in the show. But we want to hear from you at 513-419-7100. If you know the correct answer to that question, Ken, tell them what they'll win.
They will win an unbelievable weekend at Howard Wilkinson's house.
No,
they won't. But they will win a political junkie button.
Awesome. So 513-419-7100. That's the number to call, both if you want to make a comment about impeachment or the Democratic presidential primary, or take a guess at the political junkie's trivia question. So for our conversation today, though, I want to start with how Americans appear to feel about the impeachment and its process. And Ken and Howard, you both and I have spoken before about whether public opinion on impeachment would shift once the broadcast started. And so now we're here, and it still seems unclear where the truth of the matter lies. Did the president abuse his power in demanding a quid pro quo, exchanging military aid to Ukraine for an investigation into the Bidens? Or was this a sham to overturn the 2016 election? We are hearing from a variety of people, not the least of which is President Donald Trump himself. He had a campaign rally in Michigan just last evening, and we want to hear what he has to say about how he feels about all of it.
They don't even have any crime. This is the first impeachment where there's no crime. I say, tell me what I did, please. Well, we don't know. You violated the Constitution. You had Turley, who's smart, Alan Dershowitz, these guys, all of them. They say there's no crime. There's no crime, right? There's no crime. I'm the first person to ever get impeached, and there's no crime. I feel guilty. You know what they call it? Impeachment light. It's impeachment light. That's why, you know, with Richard Nixon, I just see it as a very dark era. Very dark, very, you don't even like to think. I don't know about you, but I'm having a good time. It's crazy.
President Trump says he's having a good time, and he's maintaining the talking point that there's no crime. And so they're hammering that pretty hard. He's certainly got supporters in the Congress echoing some semblance of that message. Ken, what do you make of the strategy here from the president and his elected supporters?
Wow. Well, first of all, I mean, the fact that he says he's having a good time, we know that is not the case. We know from reporters who are covering the White House closely that he is furious, that he's livid, that if you took a look at that six-page monstrosity of a letter that he sent to Nancy Pelosi and the other Democrats on Tuesday, basically it was all his angry tweets summed up in one letter. So you know he's not having a good time. You know, Michael, you led off the conversation by saying the question is where the truth lies. I don't believe there is any question of where the truth lies. There is a question of how the American people see it. We know how Congress sees it because not a single Republican, I mean, for all the Republicans who stood up and said, I'm now thinking about impeachment, Francis Rooney of Florida, Will Hurd of Texas, other Republicans who have been critical of the president, yet when it came down to it, not a single Republican voted to impeach in the House yesterday. It's questionable. People are saying, well, can you get 20 Republicans to vote for conviction in the Senate? They'll be lucky if they get two Republicans to vote. I mean, maybe Mitt Romney, maybe Susan Collins in the Senate. But the fact is that it's a cult-like situation where he has such control over the Republican Party that Richard Nixon never had, that Bill Clinton never had with his own party. And the American people, for all the impeachment inquiry, the weeks and weeks of testimony, the American people have not moved. The polls have not moved.
Howard Wilkinson, the WVXU senior political analyst. I was listening to Morning Edition just today, and Steve Inskeep was talking with a White House spokesperson who argued that Republicans were blocked out from the impeachment process, that they weren't allowed to ask questions, this, and this, which Steve Inskeep managed to push back on, even threatened to pull the mic on this spokesperson at one point. But those are the talking points that continue to come out of the administration, that this has been completely unfair, in spite of the fact that Republicans were able to participate.
Absolutely. I mean, that's all we heard was Jim Jordan shouting. And, you know, that's just not true. It's a lie. And they've built this thing on things that if anybody actually spent the time to listen to all of this, they would know it's not true.
Dr. Rachel Bloom is an assistant professor of political science at Miami University and is in the studio with us. Rachel, what do you make of this strategy of what seems to be to discredit the process rather than to address the charges?
Well, it seems to be effective in rallying the base. It's simple. It's easy to repeat. It's easy to feel mad about it. We care about process in this country. Of course, the issue when we start talking about process is it gets boring really fast for a lot of people. So if you want to make sure that nobody really looks into it much further, it's a really smart strategy. And there's not been much that Democrats have or maybe even could do to explain the process in a way that makes sense. I mean, we need at that point, we get into what the House rules are. And that is a topic I love, but most people fall asleep talking about.
I don't think you're incorrect on that. I think that just the broadcast network's approach to putting this on the air alongside their big time season finales is emblematic of those circumstances. But Ken, it's not as though the country is incapable of finding seriousness in serious moments. I think back to the Brett Kavanaugh Supreme Court confirmation hearings. It seemed that everyone was glued to their television or their smartphone watching that and try to get some fair idea of what the accusations were against him before he was confirmed for this lifetime seat. What do you think has changed in the very short time between the Kavanaugh hearings and this, which is arguably a much more serious matter?
Well, I don't know if anything has changed in the fact that both in Kavanaugh and in the impeachment hearings, there seemed to be, I mean, even especially in the impeachment hearings, but there seemed to be quite a bunch of evidence. And of course, you know, you could talk about Jonathan Turley and Alan Dershowitz all you want, but every other person who testified, every constitutional expert, every person who came forward or who were allowed, well, nobody was allowed to come forward, but they came forward on their own under tremendous personal risk to talk about how the law was being broken and yet nothing changes. So, I mean, ultimately, Kavanaugh was accused of doing horrific things. They voted him in. President Trump was accused of terrible things, and everybody, every testimony except for Jonathan Turley seemed to indicate that yes, laws were broken, the Constitution was violated, and not once a single Republican voted for it. So, for all the things that seem to be laid out before the American people, it just doesn't seem to be moving anybody. And you wonder how that will translate into next year's election.
I want to share some analysis from 538, which uses stats, of course, to cover politics, sports, and news, and is probably most widely known for its polling analysis. And they found that a majority of Americans, 54%, think there's sufficient evidence to impeach Trump over his conduct on Ukraine and his refusal to cooperate with Congress in the impeachment inquiry. But they said that there are still plenty of people, 10% of respondents, 12% of Democrats, who think Trump committed an impeachable offense, but say that it should be left up to voters in 2020 rather than by the Congress. They also went on to find that most Americans continue to believe that Trump did ask basically for the so-called quid pro quo for Ukraine to look into Joe Biden and his son Hunter Biden, who was working for a firm there in the Ukraine, in order for the U.S. to release military aid to that country. I also want to talk about how some talking points are playing. This is also according to 538 in a poll. In describing the process, this is a quote from 538, 18% of Republicans included the word waste or wasteful compared to just 4% of Democrats. Other common responses from Republicans, 538 wrote, included political and witch hunt, while Democrats use words like long, constitution, and quid pro quo. And there weren't much overlaps in the responses between those parties other than the words partisan and Trump. So that's a way that we can look at how these types of words and PR strategies are playing in the heartland, I suppose. Ken, what do you think of how, on a partisan level, average Americans are reacting to this?
Well, I think basically it's, if you're a Republican, it is a witch hunt. It is a fraud. It is a trying to overturn the 2016 election. And if you're a Democrat, you say, well, look, my goodness gracious, look at the things. It's not even just, think of all the things that were in the Mueller report. And Robert Mueller, basically, when he signed off on it, he said, I can't do anymore. My hands are tied. It's now up to Congress. What about the Stormy Daniels? What about the enriching of himself? What about the stealing from his own, from charities to enrich himself? I mean, there is so many things that Donald Trump has been accused of and has apparently done in the 3 years of his presidency. But I think this is what was Nancy Pelosi's worst nightmare. I think one of the reasons she held off on impeachment for so long is that she wanted to get a consensus, some kind of a consensus in Congress, that it would not be a partisan D's against R's, that, you know, just like with other cases, that both parties would see at least eye to eye on some issues. And that's why, I think that's why they limited the scope of the impeachment to just Ukraine, because they know there are so many Democrats out there who were elected in Trump districts in 2018 that are definitely jeopardized by any kind of vote in impeachment, because so many of them think that Donald Trump is doing a decent job. So this is was really from the beginning Nancy Pelosi's worst nightmare. The fact that when all is said and done, the Democrats vote yes, the Republicans vote no, and the needle has not changed.
513-419-7100 is the number to call if you'd like to join our conversation. We do have some folks on the line, and I want to get to those calls. I'm having a bit of a technical problem in the studio right now, and it's a rather simple one, it looks like. It's that this mouse that I use to click to put you on the air is not responding right now. So we are. Stay on the line. We're going to get to you, and after we take a break coming up, we will maybe restart the old computer or put some new batteries into this mouse. I apologize for that, but thank you for your patience. We are going to get to some of your phone calls. They are important and an important part of this program. Talking about public relations strategies as it relates to impeachment, let's move away from the polling firms and talk about the way elected officials are participating in the public sphere and talking about impeachment. And I think what's so interesting is how both parties are using references to long-term members, those who were serving in the Congress in some capacity during the impeachment process of President Bill Clinton and are still serving today, because we are seeing clips of, say, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, who, of course, is an ardent defender of President Trump. But when he was a member of the U.S. House during the impeachment of President Bill Clinton, he was calling for a fair trial so that everyone considered the facts and wanted to move forward with removing Bill Clinton from office. We saw Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat who was also serving back in 99, and said that while Clinton's conduct was wrong, it was not impeachable. And now those partisans from that era are representing different viewpoints. So I want to ask Howard, we'll start with you. Is impeachment always partisan now, or should we be able to analyze the cases of Clinton and Trump independently based on facts?
Well, we should be able to, but you can't in this atmosphere, because it is entirely partisan. Another person that you can add to that list is our own Steve Chabot, representative from the 1st District of Ohio. In the Clinton trial before the Senate, he was one of the House managers who made the case, and he was accusing Bill Clinton of abuse of power. Now he says there is no abuse of power when it comes to Donald Trump. He's totally changed his view of what constitutes an abuse of power, and this is all partisan. I mean, like you say, the needle hasn't moved since this process began, and you're right, absolutely right, that before this process began, and within the Democratic Party, there were a whole lot of people who said, "Let's not go down this road. Let's just do everything we can to defeat him in 2020.
Okay, I think we can take some phone calls from the control room. We'll have our producer take care of that. Let's go to the lines now. We have Mort up first. Hi, Mort. What's your question or comment?
I just had a comment about the big division between the two parties and between the people in our country. And I just wonder why it's never been mentioned that there's been an individual that has been for decades blaming the liberals for everything in this country, and he has been paid during those decades of time. He had a $400 million contract paying him $50 million a year. He's currently making $74 million a year, and we haven't heard anything about who this individual is and how he might be contributing to dividing the country. He's getting $2 million just from the Heritage Foundation alone.
Who are you talking about?
Hello?
Who are you talking about?
No one can guess, apparently, because it's been a well-hidden fact that Rush Limbaugh has paid $50 million a year on an 8-year contract that gives him $400 million.
Mort, we appreciate the point. It's actually one of my favorite topics, so we will hang up and discuss that, and I appreciate the call very much. Thanks for your patience in getting on the air, Mort. This is an issue. Dr. Bloom, an assistant professor of political science at Miami University, occasionally we hear about something called the Fairness Doctrine. It doesn't seem to be all that significant, but the fact of the matter is talk radio is dominated by conservative and really right-wing voices. And that influences political discourse in this country probably more severely than any other medium. When you are teaching your courses, does this issue come up at all?
Yes, a lot. And it's also one of my favorite topics. My students tend to have what I call a bias towards fairness, as in they think no matter what the two sides are, the middle is always correct. I don't quite know where this comes from, maybe a misunderstanding of the mean, the mode, the median. But we do go through the history of talk radio, and a lot of this does start in the 1950s with someone named Charles Mannion and the Mannion Forum. And Mannion uses the Fairness Doctrine even at that point to say whatever the viewpoint is that Eisenhower, the Republican, or then later Kennedy is articulating, that viewpoint is liberal because it is the government, so we need another viewpoint, which is mine. And Mannion was able to use this to try to get spots on all kinds of networks. It builds over time. It builds into Nixon, and Nixon helps it a lot. And then by the early 1990s, we see the emergence of entertainment radio. So people like Rush Limbaugh, many of the anchors on Fox News for the first time in history, aren't trained journalists. They are trained entertainers. And it completely blows up the news industry. It makes it harder for people to actually talk about the news, and it makes it harder for voters to sift through things.
But what it makes easier is the dissemination of disinformation.
Yes.
So if they are taking orders directly from the government currently, which is President Trump and his administration, they can latch on to this word sham, and they can spread it out to millions of people. When you look at the top 10 radio shows in this country, a few of them are fortunately from NPR, and most of them are right-wing talk hosts. And if you live in some markets, in Cincinnati included, and you listen to the AM side of the dial, you have right-wing host after right-wing host after right-wing host echoing the same thing
long.
Over and over. And what I find the most curious, and Ken Rudin, I'd like you to weigh in on this as a longtime media figure, what I find the most curious about those in that echo chamber is that you get this criticism of the so-called liberal media, which seems to suggest that if you're off the reservation at all, it's to be discounted at face value, and you are only to believe what is said consistently over and over on those outlets. Your thoughts, Ken?
Well, I love this topic. I absolutely love it. And just one correction, Rachel, it was Clarence. His name was Clarence Mannion.
Yes, thanks.
Not Charles Mannion. But I remember him. I remember the Clarence Mannions and the Dan Smoots and the Joe Pines. Yeah. Basically, their argument in the 1950s and the 1960s were that the media, the establishment, the media, it was just liberal. You didn't have a choice. ABC, CBS, NBC, it didn't matter. They were all liberal. And so even starting with Charles Coughlin in the 30s, but you had this succession of right-wing radio programs in the 50s, pushed on by the John Birch Society, which now sounds so fringe-ish, but back then was pretty pretty widely respected, at least widely followed, because the feeling was that Kennedy and Eisenhower and everybody else were just liberals, and we the conservatives, never had a point of view. So I mean, basically, the people today, the Rush Limbaughs of the world and the Sean Hannitys have sophisticated those old Mannion and Dan Smoot and Joe Pine kind of broadcast to make it the fact that people are just now no longer trust. I mean, I think Vietnam also was part of the thing that people just stopped trusting the government, and these people filled the void that was definitely there was definitely a hole waiting to be filled.
Yeah, there was nothing slick about Joe Pine. I mean, it was raw. It was natural. It was just
I used to listen to him.
I used to listen to it too, yeah. And. You know, it made Hannity and Limbaugh seem like milquetoast.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. 513-419-7100 is the number to call to join our conversation. We will continue our chat about the impeachment process, and we'll start when we come back. We'll listen to a little bit more of what the president said at his rally in Michigan. He took a shot at the late dean of the U.S. House, which has upset that man's widow. We'll hear that clip coming up. I'll remind you of our monthly trivia question from Ken Rudin. The question is, who was the last senator currently in office right now to vote against their party in both counts in a presidential impeachment vote? You could win a political junkie button. 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. We continue now with the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Hi, Ken.
Hello, Michael. By the way, I just heard that thing about the Cincinnati Zoo. I love the Cincinnati Zoo. Fantastic zoo.
We love the zoo as well. Maybe when you come to town early next year, we'll take a little trip over.
We'll take you there.
And that's Howard Wilkinson, our senior political analyst. Hi, Howard.
Uh-oh. Michael.
And we have Miami University Assistant Professor of Political Science, Dr. Rachel Bloom. Dr. Bloom, thanks for being with us as well.
Hi.
513-419-7100 is the number to call. We'll get to some of those calls on the line in a moment. I'm still having a computer mouse problem, so I can't personally click. We're waiting for the producer in there to be prepared. Okay, we've got some who can. Josh Elstro, our technical director, is going to get some of these calls on. And next up is Ron. Let's go to Ron. Hi, Ron. What's your question or comment?
I got a comment on the impeachment. I think, in a way, they should have given the people the vote and let them decide. The way things have been running up for the past 3 weeks in Washington, D.C., they've been pretty much massacring everybody on the Republican side. I've been a Democrat all my life, and I've never seen such a sham in my life. The way they said that they were going to impeach this man from day one. They have something on him, but I don't think they have enough for impeachment.
Okay, Ron, we thank you very much for that call. Next up on the list is Gene. Hi, Gene. What's your question or comment?
Hi. I can't believe, first of all, the obstruction of justice and the not responding to the subpoenas. I thought that was against the law. I thought you had to respond to a subpoena and not saying no. And second of all, there's so much. I have so much. And I have watched the video about Hitler and fascism in Europe and see that, you know, the economy was up and jobs were up. Joblessness was down. And all of that kind of stuff. And are we not seeing something coming here if we keep...
Gene, we appreciate that call and your comment as well. Thank you very much. Next up, we have on the line Dottie. Hi, Dottie. What's your question or comment?
So my comment is that one of the things that really annoyed me was hearing the constant, you know, let the election results decide, wait for the next election. And I sort of feel that a lot of this partisanship, well, it was before that, but that it really got much worse was when they basically decided that Obama was really only elected for 3 years because they wouldn't do the confirmation of Merrick Garland. So essentially, the Republicans, you know, at that time decided to ignore the election results of the Obama election by not doing their due process of the Merrick Garland confirmation.
All right. We appreciate that call very much, Dottie. Thank you so much for your contribution. 513-419-7100. Let's go back to President Trump's rally in Michigan. And we've got two clips to play where he's talking about members of Congress. And Josh, if you don't mind, just play those back to back.
I see a woman, Carolyn Maloney. She's a long time, nothing much, believe me. She's a Congresswoman from Manhattan, East Side. I was with her. Her first race, I helped her. She was always so nice. Oh, thank you, thank you. I made lots of contributions over the years. You know, in New York, if you're not, it's like purely Democrat, especially Manhattan. So what happens, I make lots of contributions, years and years and years. I go run. The first person I see, Carolyn Maloney. I raise my hand to impeach. Well, give me back the damn money that I've been paying her for so many years. Let her pay me back all the money. Then you have this Dingell. You know Dingell from Michigan? You know Dingell? You ever hear of her, Michigan? Debbie Dingell, that's a real beauty. So she calls me up like 8 months ago. Her husband was here a long time. But I didn't give him the B treatment. I didn't give him the C or the D. I could have. Nobody would have, you know. I gave the A-plus treatment. Take down the flags. Why are you taking them down? For ex-Congressman Dingell. Oh, okay. Do this, do that, do that. Rotunda, everything. I gave him everything. That's okay. I don't want anything for it. I don't need anything for anything. She calls me up. It's the nicest thing that's ever happened. Thank you so much. John would be so thrilled. He's looking down. He'd be so thrilled. Thank you so much, sir. I said, that's okay. Don't worry about it. Maybe he's looking up. I don't know.
Ken Rudin, the political junkie, you heard the president there basically insult a dead congressman, the longest serving U.S. congressman ever. What do you make of this?
You want to find an impeachable offense? That was an impeachable offense. That was so disgraceful, implying, of course, that John Dingell, the longest-serving congressman in the history of Congress from Michigan, who died last February, is looking up from hell. The thought of him saying that, it reminds me of, and Matt Gaetz, the congressman from Florida, the other day was talking about Hunter Biden's cocaine pipe and all the drugs he's done while Matt Gaetz has a DUI that he got off the hook because of his father. Anyway, the fact is, there is nothing. It's one thing for Trump to have all these private grievances, and we saw that in the six-page letter to Nancy Pelosi. And it's interesting that he picked on Carolyn Maloney and Debbie Dingell, two women, two female members of Congress, which he loves to do. Mm-hmm. But to talk about the late John Dingell and to talk about the fact that he's coming, looking from above, you know, looking up from hell, is beyond. It's beyond. And Republicans to a T defend, actually, Fred Upton, a Republican congressman from Michigan, he tweeted, said that is unbelievably disrespectful and cruel. But for the most part, the Republicans, every time he does something like this, they all just stay silent. And to me, in many ways, this is among the worst things he could possibly do. And he does it and he gets away with it.
Yeah, this is appalling. I mean, it may well be the most appalling thing I've ever heard him say, and that's going a long ways. Just before we went on the air, the White House press secretary responded to all the criticism that he is getting for that remark about John Dingell and said that, well, the president is a counterpuncher. He was just doing a riff off the crowd. He's a counterpuncher. Well, it seems to me that he enjoys counterpunching against live women and dead men, one of them being John Dingell, the other being John McCain. We've heard this stuff before out of him. It is absolutely unforgivable. And I'm with Ken. I said, you know, that's an impeachable offense.
And Cindy McCain, the widow of John McCain, tweeted today she shares Debbie Dingell's concerns about the president's remarks. Right. Dr. Bloom, what I thought was unique about that particular clip where the president suggested that John Dingell is looking up from hell was you heard a little bit of a groan in the audience. And you don't often hear groans from Trump rallies. It's usually hooing and hawing and cheering about what the president has said. No matter how low he goes, they find it amusing is what it looks like more than anything. It's just a joke. It's just an insult. That one caught a groan. Does that say anything?
It's hard to tell. I mean, I wasn't sure when I listened to it whether it was a groan because of what he said or a groan about hell, right? It could have been supportive. I'm not really sure. The real question, of course, is whether any kind of groan or joke could make a lot of people for whom partisanship is their identity allow themselves to ask questions about who they're supporting or whether that person really is part of the party that they support or anything like that. And I'm not sure at this point that a funeral comment would tip the scales when nothing else has.
We're going to get back to the phones in just a moment, 513-419-7100. But Ken, I think somebody has a guess for your trivia question. And we will read the question again. Ken, do you have it handy?
The last senator, who's the last senator who's currently in office to vote against their party in both counts in a presidential impeachment vote?
Okay, let's go to Greg. Hi, Greg. You want to take a guess?
I would love to. I'm not sure about this, but I believe that it's the great Susan Collins, Republican from the state of Maine.
It is Susan Collins. That is the correct answer.
Oh, congratulations, Greg. Ken, tell him what he's won.
He's won 2 weeks in Maine. No, he's won a political junkie
I'll take
button.
That.
Fascinating. That's true. I remember the Maine, as they said in 1898.
Right.
Sorry. But actually, she is in trouble. We talked about Kavanaugh earlier. She's one of those moderate Republicans who has had to walk a fine line. But this, and she always gets reelected. But this time, voting with Kavanaugh, dismissing the women's complaints about sexual harassment, which turned off a lot of female Democrats who have always been voting for her. She's in a tough race this year, and there's going to be a lot of pressure on her to vote one way or the other.
And she could play a significant role in this impeachment process. We're going to talk about what may be House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's strategy and how it could incorporate some fair-minded Republican members of the U.S. Senate. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. It's our full hour of national politics and your phone calls with the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Hey, Ken.
Hi, Michael.
WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson is here.
Yes, sir.
And we also have Miami University assistant professor of political science, Dr. Rachel Bloom. Rachel, thank you for being here as well.
You're welcome.
Just before we went to break, we were talking about Republican Maine Senator Susan Collins. And Howard, there appears to be a possible strategy emerging on behalf of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, a delay in delivering the impeachment process to the U.S. Senate. And this may involve getting some Republicans on board in that chamber, in the upper chamber, to ensure what Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer would call a fair trial.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, there have been several very high-profile examples of starting with Mitch McConnell, obviously, of Republicans saying, well, we're not going to do a fair trial. We've already made up our minds. This is going to be, you know, bing, bang, boom. You're free to go, Mr. President. And Nancy Pelosi does not have to deliver these articles of impeachment to them immediately. It doesn't work that way. That's why we have a bicameral legislature. And she wants to use it as some leverage.
So the strategy would be to see if they could gather some Republican support in the Senate to allow for witnesses to testify.
Yes.
And they don't need the two-thirds majority you would need to convict, right? You need
exactly.
A simple majority.
That's right.
Which is three or four Republicans that would have to come over.
Yeah, that's right. And in the meantime, the other investigations of Donald Trump, the New York Attorney General and the Manhattan District Attorney, those things go on. And, we don't know where they're going to lead yet, but it could make for a much stronger case.
There could be more evidence presented and more to consider. Ken, I'm wondering what you think about the way House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has handled this entire process leading up to now and what she might do next.
Well, that's a great question, Michael. And the reason I appreciate it so much is if you remember during the midterm elections in 2018, there were many Democrats who were saying, I'm not going to vote for her for Speaker. She's old. She's out of touch. She's the old politics. It's time for somebody new. And I think given the circumstances involved in something as monumental as impeachment, she has done an amazing job keeping her party together. You think of powerful speakers of the past, she's done just an amazing job, and not one that she wished she had done. I mean, in other words, she said from the beginning, there was earlier a call from somebody who said that the Democrats were trying to impeach him from the beginning. That's not true with Nancy Pelosi. She actually fought it for the longest time. So basically, she doesn't have much leverage. The House voted to impeach. It's now up to Mitch McConnell and the Senate. By her, and Howard's exactly right, by her holding off on sending the articles to the Senate by not naming impeachment managers, like Steve Chabot was with Clinton, she is hoping that there'll be some kind of negotiations between McConnell and Chuck Schumer that is more beneficial, a little more favorable to the Democrats. Otherwise, she can hold off as long as she wants. Now, I don't know if everybody in the Democratic Party wants that, but in other words, she has some power that a lot of people thought she may have lost once the House finished its business.
Rachel, we are just a couple of weeks away from officially being in an election year. And now that's got to be some consideration for vulnerable incumbents who are facing an election in 2020 or maybe even a primary challenge. Is there any danger in delaying this process, or is there a possibility that this could bolster your chances if you wait and have the opportunity to present a stronger case? What do you think the political ramifications could be of either scenario?
I think Democrats have been considering that for quite a while, and obviously some Republicans are considering that too. The reason it could be a danger for some people is because they could face a primary challenge And for a Democrat, that could come from the left, but it could also come from the center. For others, Democrats and Republicans, they could face a challenger from the other party. And here we would look at people who are in districts that either went Obama, and then Trump, or districts that are solidly Trump but went Democrat in 2018. I think this is a very individualized calculation for a lot of House members, but that is passed, right? So now we're dealing with the Senate, and only one third of that chamber is up for reelection in any given cycle. They have 6-year terms, so they're a lot less beholden to the whims of the electorate. So basically, we'd have to look at the people who are up in 2020.
Okay, let's get through some phone calls, and then we'll talk about the Democratic primary, presidential primary debate that is tonight. Next up on the line is Amy. Hi, Amy. What's your question or comment? Do we have Amy on the line? Somebody click for – I'm sorry, Amy. Hang on. Hey, Amy. Are you there, Amy?
This is something that we need to remember. A couple of the things that you guys have touched on today, specifically the 538 poll, where really the only people who are watching and listening throughout the day and the average household are Democratic. This is a very blown-up TV show, and our star of our TV show happens to be a former TV personality. So you have both sides of this for the average American wanting to be played out in different ways based on how they're watching the show. For the Democrats who are reading the transcripts, who are listening, who are following along with it, we see the questions, we're analyzing, we're looking at this from a fairness standpoint. For the Republicans who are at work during the day and then come home to turn on their Sean Hannity or whatever, they're seeing the sound bites. They're being told, this is what happened, this is all you need to know.
All right, Amy, we appreciate that call very much and the analysis that you offered us. Thanks so much for staying on hold and giving us that call. Let's go to David now. Hi, David. What's your question or comment?
Hi. My question is, the Republicans were consistently screaming that they wanted their day in court. They wanted a minority day. They wanted to bring witnesses. And it seems to me it would have bolstered the Democrats' position to allow that. So to make it seem as though it was just a question of right and wrong, and it wasn't partisan. And I'm wondering what the panel thinks the reason was for not allowing the Republicans time to air their side.
All right, David, thank you very much for that. Ken, what do you think about that? Did the Republicans not get their opportunity to make their case?
Well, if you ask the Democrats, the answer is no. They had the opportunity to cross-examine witnesses. Yes, they wanted to invite their own guests. They wanted to invite Hunter Biden, and they wanted to invite Joe Biden and maybe Hillary Clinton and maybe, Mary Jo Kopechne from Chappaquiddick. They were blaming everybody else, but when the real people who knew information, the John Boltons, the Mick Mulvaneys, the Mike Pompeos, the Mike Pence, the President of the United States, those who knew stuff, they refused to talk. So I think it's a little kind of like falling on deaf ears, demanding witnesses that may have been very peripheral, if nothing to do with it, and ignoring the Democrats' request for people who were involved in the schemes to testify.
Ken Rudin with a Chappaquiddick reference. So thanks for our helping our efforts in getting that younger demo to pay attention to us and know what's going on. Before we run out of time, I think we've got to talk about the Democrats who are trying to replace Trump the electoral way. And they have a debate tonight. It's at 8 o'clock. You will be able to hear NPR's coverage of that live on 91.7 WVXU. If you want to listen to it, tune in to us. Dr. Bloom, I'd like to ask you, who has the most to gain? Who has the most to lose tonight?
Well, the stage has shrunk a little bit. And
we're down to seven candidates only.
Yes. And there are a couple different ways to slice this. So you could try to look at it, and I'm not sure I really like this, but you could try to talk about the different wings, factions, lanes, whatever you want to call them, based on ideology. And then there does seem to be some sort of Warren Sanders wing and some sort of more moderate wing. I think that there's still not a lot of consensus on who best would represent the party. So someone who saw themselves as a front runner, so maybe a Warren or a Biden, could do a lot in this debate for the people watching. I'm not that convinced that this debate alone is going to be decisive of the primary outcomes.
Howard, we're not that far away from the first votes finally being cast in Iowa, New Hampshire, and then South Carolina, Nevada. Who do you think has the most to lose tonight? Joe Biden has led consistently in national polls from basically start to finish.
I don't know. I think Buttigieg has a lot to riding on this tonight. But, you know, most of this, I think, is going to be played out on the ground in Iowa, in New Hampshire, and South Carolina. I mean, that's where it's going to be played out, and that's where the winners and losers are going to come from, not from these debates, which are good entertainment and good for getting name recognition and that sort of thing. But I'm not sure it's going to decide anything. But I think, like I said, Mayor Pete needs to do very well tonight, I think.
Yeah, Mayor Pete has managed to elevate his national profile, certainly, over the past few weeks. Ken, I'm wondering about Senator Amy Klobuchar, the Democrat from Minnesota, who has managed to qualify for all of these debates. She's never resonated too much in the polls, but she has not been able to secure that centrist, moderate Democratic lane that Biden and Buttigieg have occupied with more support. And why do you think that is?
I don't know, actually, but I do think that she has shown some impressive moments in the debates lately. I thought she had the last one or two. She was very, very good. But you're absolutely right. That moderate lane that's maybe run by Biden and now Buttigieg is trying to be a part of, even though once upon a time he was considered one of the more progressive candidates, it seems to be blocked. And, you know, she's not raising a ton of money. It's the kind of situation that, being from Minnesota, I suspect that if she doesn't finish in the top two or three in Iowa, she's finished. But one thing is interesting. First of all, we always talk about Joe Biden being the national front runner. And he is. Of course, there's no national primary. It starts in Iowa on February 3rd, and it goes from there. And the fact that one, Buttigieg is now the new darling of the Democrats. It used to be Biden, then it was Elizabeth Warren, and now it seems to be Buttigieg. So I'm watching to see if he's the subject of attacks. Elizabeth Warren is already attacking him for his fundraising and maybe some of his consultants. So he may be on the defensive as well. And Joe Biden, for all the talk about him being a national frontrunner, I think every debate he's been in, he's been, I don't know if disastrous is the right word, but he has disappointed everyone. He's confused sometimes. He has rambling answers, sort of like me during your program. But the fact is that he does not seem sharp. And for all the argument that he's the best guy to defeat Donald Trump, I have not seen it in the debates as of yet.
Well, Ken, in our last 30 seconds or so, I'm wondering if you think that a lot of these think pieces we're seeing emerge about Mayor Pete Buttigieg and whether he's really a Republican or some corporate Democrat. Is this indicative that the left of the party is ready to, I don't know, implode if there's a more moderate candidate nominated?
Well, that's been the fight. We saw that fight with Hillary and Bernie in 2016. The fact is that there were a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters, and I spoke to them during the convention, who would never vote for Hillary Clinton because they felt she was a corporatist and not where the party should go. So I don't know I would like to think that the Democrats learned their lesson from 2016 and make sure that whomever the nominee is, they will support. But those ideological factions exist. And of course, if Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren joined forces, they would probably be much more powerful than they are now. And basically, when they see the party like Michael Bloomberg, who is now, you know, spending gazillion dollars, you can't turn on the TV without seeing a Michael Bloomberg commercial. If that's the way the Democratic Party, there are a lot of progressives who say, this is not the party I like.
All right. Our thanks to Fred, Tatiana, Lori, and Brendan, and the rest who called in. We could not get to you. I blame this mouse that needs new batteries. Please give to public radio. We need it. Ken Rudin, the political junkie, thank you for another fun month. We appreciate it very much. Merry Christmas to you. Howard Wilkinson, WVXU senior political analyst, and Professor Rachel Bloom from Miami University, thank you for being here as well. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks.